dead. Either way, the woman dies. She means nothing to me. All I want is a clear shot at you. You have murdered her. Let it be on your head! Bandar howled in a frenzy. His finger tightened on the trigger. Wait! Yusef called. Bandar hesitated. If he fired, he was doomed. His last card had been trumped. He had only malevolence left. Settle this the way it began, with Kanjars. The woman is the prize for the victor, Yusef said. An utter silence settled like dust over the desert. The wind died, and the sand ceased its timeless whisper. Only the ragged animal breathing of the woman could be heard anywhere. So be it, Bandar announced contemptuously. He flung the woman aside and tossed the AK-47 back into the jeep. The Kanjar glittered in his hand as he waited. A trembling Kelly crawled behind the wing, her eyes wide as saucers, an unreadable look in them. Do this for me. If he should win, shoot him, the scorpion muttered to Yusef out of the side of his mouth. As Allah is my judge, Yusef swore. The scorpion stood and dropped his gun. He pulled the Kanjar from his belt sheath and stepped out from behind the Land Rover. Bandar and the scorpion stood facing each other about 10 feet apart. The sand was warm and red as blood. The setting sun had turned them all into figures of fire and shadow. The scorpion's heart pounded. It was for this moment that he had been born. His kismet had brought him to this desolate arena as surely as if he had been guided along a track. Now all the remembered insults and humiliations came back. Rage bubbled under icy control within him, the optimal killing attitude. They both went into a crouching stance, knives held before them, circling in a deadly right as ancient as time itself, never taking their eyes off the opponent's dagger. The blades were razor sharp. They glittered like rubies in the scarlet dusk light. Bandar suddenly dropped his shoulder and stabbed forward, the blade tip coming within an inch of the scorpion's belly, but the scorpion didn't flinch. He had judged it a feint. They circled in the sand, feinting and dodging to test each other's reflexes. The scorpion flicked his kanjar at Bandar's wrist. Bandar's blade circled under the scorpion's and stabbed at the scorpion's heart. The scorpion twisted aside at the last second. Allah, he thought. Bandar was quick as a cat. Bandar's bad eye glowed red as a bloodstone. The scorpion moved. He feinted at Bandar's arm, then circled under Bandar's parry and thrust forward. Bandar's kanjar slashed back at the scorpion's, blade ringing dully against blade, and then they were apart, circling again. This time a new wariness had come into Bandar's good eye. Bandar stepped back 2 paces, whirled, and as he turned back towards the scorpion, there was a shadow of something dark in his other hand. The scorpion heard a muffled scream from Kelly's direction, even as he reacted with a back-to-front crescent kick. His foot caught Bandar's automatic as the trigger jerked and sent the gun spinning into the shadows as it fired. The loud report shattered the stillness like crystal. With a wild howl, Bandar came at the scorpion, slashing savagely and methodically. The scorpion backed away, parrying the blows, blade to blade, counter-slashing back. Suddenly, Bandar feinted left and struck right. The scorpion twisted away from the thrust and kicked out, his foot catching Bandar's shoulder and knocking him sideways. But his own footing slipped and he went down. Bandar was on him like a bull on a matador, stabbing in a frenzy. The scorpion saw the blade coming at his groin as if in slow motion. He grabbed a handful of sand with his left hand and flung it into Bandar's face as he rolled just out of reach. Bandar howled like a blinded cyclops and slashed wildly at the scorpion. Now, the scorpion told himself as he scrambled to his feet. Now! He stepped inside the circle of Bandar's frenzy, using a forearm to block against Bandar's forearm and side-kicking at the inside of Bandar's knee. As Bandar began to go down, he thrust desperately up at the scorpion's ribcage. The scorpion chopped at Bandar's wrist with the hard edge of his left hand as he simultaneously made a wrist-twisting slash with a kanjar, disemboweling Bandar with a single wrenching cut. Bandar's scream was not human. His insides spilled out onto the sand like tangled snakes. He slithered on the ground like a dying worm, slashing at the scorpion's feet in his final frenzy. The scorpion danced out of the way, and with a single savage slice, cut the forearm muscle of Bandar's knife hand to the bone. He watched Bandar writhing in agony on the ground, screaming unintelligible sounds. Suddenly, an M16 opened fire. Bandar arched his back like a bow and was still. His good eyes stared open and empty at the evening star rising over the dunes of Dana. "Now it's over. Ayesha is paid for," Yusef said, standing over Bandar, the M16 dangling from his hand. Kelly came wordlessly up to the scorpion, and they stumbled back towards the Land Rover, their arms around each other. Before they got into the Land Rover, she put her blistered lips to his ear and whispered, "I have to know. Would you have let him kill me?" The scorpion caressed her long blonde hair with his torn fingers and kissed her lips with great tenderness. His eyes were sparks of fire in the last red rays of the sun. "No," he said. It was the first lie of their relationship. Bab al-Bahrain. The midnight silence of the dark, narrow street was broken by the barking of a small dog. It belonged to the owner of the Dar, who kept it in the tiny courtyard shaded by eucalyptus trees that he shared with the Inglisi. The yellowish mongrel stood in the center of the courtyard, barking at the shadows. A dark figure came out of the shadows, and the dog flattened his ears and charged, yipping wildly. A sudden movement, and the dog lay motionless in the shadows. The figure stumbled hurriedly across the moonlit courtyard and knocked at Braithwaite's back door. The door was flung open, and a rectangle of light splashed almost, but not quite, to the feet of the small carcass.
"A mare! Come in, dear boy!" Braithwaite stuttered.
The young Shiite slipped in, glancing nervously behind him as Braithwaite carefully closed and locked the door. He turned and, tenderly taking the Shiite's hand, led him to the divan. The Shiite leaned his expensive lizard-skin attaché case against the divan. It looked out of place next to the threadbare upholstery.
"I fear for you," Braithwaite said.
"You should," the Arab burst out petulantly. "Your scorpion has ruined us."
His sweat-slick face reflected the lamplight like a discolored mirror. At the sound of his voice, the cobra stirred evilly in its basket, flicking its forked tongue repeatedly in their direction. At the sight of him, a mare shivered like a trapped animal. It reminded him of how much he had dreaded coming here. But Nuruddin had insisted.
"I hate that crazy old Kuni. Him and that filthy snake of his. Every time he touches me, it makes my flesh crawl," he had protested.
"Remember Katif," Nuruddin had replied, his eyes narrowed. In 1979, a group of religious zealots led by a fanatic who proclaimed himself to be the long-awaited Mahdi had invaded the sacred mosque in Mecca. When they heard the news, the suppressed Shiite minority had rioted for days in the city of Katif. The rioters had been ruthlessly suppressed by the Royal Saudi Army. Although none of Amer's family had been hurt, his mother's family had come from Katif, and he had taken it personally.
"Why not just leave him? Let the old Kuni take his chances," he had objected, a spoiled whine in his voice.
When he had first become involved with Nuruddin, they had told him he was a hero. But when he heard the sounds of battle as they fled Daria, and their Mercedes had been buzzed by a Royal Army helicopter, he could scarcely breathe. And when he saw the bodies near Riyadh airport after the fighting mare, he had gagged and barely had time to stick his head out of the window to be sick. They hadn't told him it was going to be like this.
"If either the scorpion or Al-Amir, his police ashab, gets to Braithwaite, they'll get to you and through you to me," Nuruddin had said.
"Better to kill the old fool," Amer had truculently insisted, not realizing the implication of what he was saying. "In time," soothed Nuruddin, an odd gleam in his eye that made Amer tremble. "In the meantime, you must get the old man to Europe. Once there, you can abandon him as you like. It is all arranged. The Rusis will protect you. But how to convince Braithwaite to leave, Amer wondered, glancing at the old man. The Americani was supposed to have died. It was Nuruddin's fault. Now they were all marked men. Alamir is after me. And after him, the Scorpion. They will kill us, Amer cried.
I'll talk to him, Habibi. I still have clout, you know, Braithwaite said.
In the corner, the snake began to coil, as though to strike.
It's too late for that. We have to run. To Europe. It's all arranged, Amer insisted.
Why was the old man being so stubborn?
I couldn't let you. Not with martial law and all, Braithwaite insisted.
He hugged the younger man to his bony chest, holding him tightly.
Help me, pleaded Amer, tears starting out of the corners of his eyes.
When all else failed, tears had always worked for him.
Oh, my dear, Braithwaite murmured
and kissed Amer full on the lips. Amer suffered it. He'd do anything to get the old cooney to move. Sheikh Al-Khatifa's police might come barging in at any minute.
I have been given false passports, money, instructions, everything, Amer gasped, pulling out of the embrace.
He placed the attaché case on the coffee table.
Where did you get this? Nuruddin?
Braithwaite inquired, throwing a sudden suspicious glance at Amer. How deep in was Amer, he wondered. He began to realize that it might be too late to save the boy. Amer nodded. He was to go over everything with Braithwaite. The papers and the money would convince the old man, Nuruddin had insisted, handing over the locked case. And they must do it when alone, and in a place safe from prying eyes. To have such papers was proof of their treason, he had reminded the Shiite. The prescribed penalty for such an offense was 100 lashes followed by beheading. The very thought of it made Amer queasy.
Show me, Braithwaite commanded.
Amer took the key from his pocket and turned it in the lock. The sudden explosion shattered the silent night. The street was illuminated by a brilliant orange fireball that made the old stone houses glow red as though dusk had returned. In a white Mercedes parked far down the street, Nuruddin leaned forward and tapped his driver on the shoulder. As the Mercedes passed the shattered ruin of Braithwaite's building, Nuruddin nodded with satisfaction. What was left of the side of the building was a wall of flames. There could be no survivors. Now at least two loose ends were taken care of, he thought. As the car sped through the silent streets of Manama back towards the old walled gate of the city, the Bab al-Bahrain, and then on towards the airport road, Nuruddin nervously fingered his prayer beads and tried to decide what to do. He had to get away from Bahrain, but where? Salim's forces had put down all resistance, and the American presence in the Gulf was stronger than ever. How would Moscow react now that the Molotov plan was a complete shambles? Ya Allah! But it was all because of that Scorpion and Prince Abdul Saad's incompetence. Who would have believed it? The man was a demon. 4 times they had set traps for him, and 4 times he had escaped. He had blown the plot and sent the survivors scurrying in the darkness like rats, their nest destroyed. But at least he, Nuruddin, had tied up the last 2 loose ends which could link the Arabian fiasco to the Russians. Moscow hated loose ends. Well, at least his immediate plans were set. He had to catch the Concorde flight to Paris, then on to Geneva with the help of sympathetic French communist intellectuals. Once in Switzerland, well, the Swiss knew how to treat someone with a large numbered bank account. Then he could safely gauge Moscow's mood. The Mercedes began to slow. Annoyed, Nuruddin began to lean forward to tap his driver. Didn't the fool understand he had a plane to catch? Then he saw the flashing yellow lights of the police roadblock at the Bab al-Bahrain. Nuruddin frowned. Was it possible that Alamir had reacted so quickly? He began to sweat. Then he relaxed. It was a standard police roadblock. Since the fighting in Arabia, Bahrain had been under martial law. There were roadblocks at all major intersections, he reminded himself. He leaned back and reached for his well-upholstered wallet. Allah be praised, Bahrain was still a civilized place where bakshish could buy any official. With a familiar sigh, he began calculating how much he would need to bribe his way through the roadblock. The two figures watched the white Mercedes approach the roadblock from the darkness of a parked sedan. One of the figures lit a cigarette. It glowed in the darkness like a firefly. They watched the Mercedes stop and said nothing. A Bahraini police sergeant glanced in the direction of the parked car and spotted the cigarette glow. He motioned to his men as they approached the Mercedes, submachine guns at the ready. The sergeant motioned for the windows to be rolled down, then demanded their papers. The two figures in the sedan watched the nervously smiling brown face in the back seat of the Mercedes lean forward to hand over an identity card, together with what was obviously a thick wad of reals. Suddenly, Nuruddin's smile froze as the submachine guns swung into position. The sound of automatic fire shattered the night as the three policemen sprayed the interior of the Mercedes for a full 30 seconds, turning the car into a bleeding metal sieve. Then the police jumped into a patrol car and sped away. Other policemen quickly dismantled the roadblock and drove away in another car. It was over in seconds. An unreal silence returned to the intersection, blocked by the unmoving Mercedes. The two figures in the sedan glanced at each other.
"Good job, Lieutenant. I'm sure Asaid Al-Amir will be pleased with your efficiency," the Scorpion said.
"I'll tell him of your approval. And will you be leaving Bahrain shortly?"
the young Bahraini police lieutenant asked, raising his eyebrow to indicate that this was Al-Amir's polite way of telling the Scorpion to get out. The Scorpion nodded and said,
"I have only to go back to the hotel and collect the woman who has suffered much in all this."
The Bahraini raised his hands as if in surrender.
"Everything is understood. Go with Allah and unto you peace. This," he said with a nod to indicate the unmoving Mercedes, "is the last of them, isn't it?"
"It's all over now," the Scorpion said and started to leave the car.
Then he turned back to the Bahraini for a moment.
"Just out of curiosity, how will you explain all this to the public?" gesturing at the Mercedes.
"We'll blame it on foreign agents. After all, it's foreigners who cause all the trouble in the Middle East anyway."
The Bahraini shrugged. From the moment he entered the Gulf Hotel lobby, the Scorpion knew something had gone wrong. For one thing, there were too many Arabs in Western suits with nothing to do at that hour of the morning in the lobby. An Arab who had "cop" painted indelibly all over him was taking an exaggerated interest in his copy of yesterday's Al-Bilad. He could feel eyes on his back as he entered the elevator. He pressed the button for the floor above his and took out the big Colt automatic, standing to the side of the door in case they were waiting to cut him down as soon as the door slid open, as they'd done to Fleming in Vienna.
If it weren't for Kelly waiting for him in the room, he'd be heading for the exit now, he thought. The elevator slowed, and he checked the mirror before leaping out, gun first. The hotel corridor was silent and empty. He crept quietly to the emergency exit and down the stairs to his floor. The corridor near his room was also empty, but he sensed it was being watched. He glanced up at the lighting fixtures as if they were looking back at him. When he came to the door to his room, he found proof that it wasn't his imagination lying on the carpet next to the door. A tiny sliver of transparent, almost invisible plastic which he had wedged between the door and the jamb. The Scorpion cocked the automatic. His palms began to sweat. According to standard procedure, he was standing in the red zone and should get out. If the door was rigged to an explosive, they could mail him home. But Kelly might still be there, he told himself. There was no going back. With infinite care, he turned the key in the lock. He held his breath. Nothing. He flung the door open and somersaulted into the center of the room, coming up in a crouch, his gun ready, but it was pointless.
"That was quite an entrance, Scorpion. But I think you're outgunned,"
Al-Amir said, glancing around the room at the half-dozen of his men, their automatic weapons trained on the Scorpion.
"Where's the girl, Jassim?" the Scorpion asked.
"Gone." "No, we had nothing to do with it,"
the Bahraini chief of police added hurriedly, seeing the iciness come into the Scorpion's gray eyes.
"It was your own people, company business. And I fear she seemed quite willing, Habibi."
The Scorpion shook his head. It made no sense. What about all this, a welcoming committee? Al-Amir bit his lip and absent-mindedly rubbed the scar on his cheek. He was obviously troubled. It's your own people. CIA. They want you terminated, Scorpion. This is your firing squad. I don't get it. Amir shrugged and said, Neither do I. If it were up to me, you'd get a medal. You Americani are very difficult to understand. Scorpion aimed the Colt at Al-Amir's head. I'll take you with me, Jassim, he said. Al-Amir raised his hands in mock surrender. No need, Scorpion. I'm letting you go. A matter of sentiment. My lord, Sheikh Al-Khatifa, is related through his maternal grandmother to your adopted father, Sheikh Zayed. Also, he wants to stay in King Salim's good graces, and Salim owes you a life. But I must ask you to leave Bahrain at once. Things have been very noisy since you came to Manama, Scorpion, he said, leaning back on the sofa. The Scorpion nodded and put away the gun. He sat on the sofa next to Al-Amir and poured himself a drink of iced mineral water. His heart was pounding and there was a roaring in his head as if he were holding seashells to his ears. I wouldn't go back to the States if I were you, he heard Al-Amir say. The Scorpion shook his head. I'll report you dead. With both the CIA and the KGB wanting to terminate you, it's your only chance, Al-Amir added. What will you do for a body? The Scorpion asked. The driver of the Mercedes will do nicely for the CIA. The guns made quite a mess of him. I'm having his body brought here now. The Scorpion stared into space. He raised the glass to his lips, but didn't drink. The pattern was rearranging in his head. None of it made any sense, and then, all at once, it all made perfect sense. He drank the mineral water as if it were hemlock. He had made the worst mistake an agent can make. He had completely misunderstood the nature of his mission. Part 4. One day a scorpion stood on the bank of a river. He wanted to cross it, but scorpions can't swim. So he went up to a frog and proposed that the frog carry him across. But the frog was afraid. You might sting me and I'll die, said the frog. Nonsense. If I sting you and you die, then I'm bound to drown too, the scorpion replied. So the frog agreed, and he began to swim across the river with the scorpion on his back. When they were halfway across, the scorpion stung the frog. With his last gasp, just before he sank, the frog asked the scorpion, But why? Now you'll die, too. It doesn't make any sense. I can't help it. I'm a scorpion. It's in my nature to sting, said the scorpion. An Arab story, circa 8th century A.D. Watergate. Don't turn on the light. Harris's hand hesitated by the switch. He had just come in. The apartment was dark except for the lights of the city reflected on the glass balcony door. Was that how the intruder had come in, he wondered. He carefully began to reach for his shoulder holster with his free hand. Another inch and I'll blow it away, the voice snapped sharply. It was at once chilling and yet oddly familiar. Who are you? What do you want? Harris whispered nervously. His throat was dry. Use your left hand. Take out your gun and toss it on the carpet, the voice ordered. Harris did as he was told. He tried to locate the voice. It seemed to be coming from somewhere in the living room. A blow to the stomach doubled him over, knocking the wind out of him, followed by a savage kick in the mouth, which sent him spinning to the floor. By the time he regained his senses, his hands had been tied behind him. He didn't have to check to know that the knots were tight and professional. Although it wasn't cold, he began to tremble. He had recognized the voice. Is that you, Nick? Harris asked in a shaky voice. Nick disappeared a long time ago, the voice said. "The scorpion?" Harris managed to whisper. "He's dead, haven't you heard? How did you get into my apartment?" "Come on, Bob. I thought security at the Watergate was a pretty cliched topic," the voice said. "You wouldn't do anything crazy. I mean, you're too smart for that," Harris squeaked, unable to conceal the quaver in his voice. "A scorpion only knows how to do one thing, Bob. It knows how to sting," the scorpion said. "Listen, I can explain," Harris began. "I know. You're good at that." The scorpion was seated in an armchair. He motioned Harris to the couch opposite him. Like Harris, the scorpion wore a dinner jacket and black tie. Lounging across from each other like that against the backdrop of the city lights, they could have been posing for a whiskey ad. For a moment they sat silently in the dark apartment, Harris watching the scorpion glancing away at the city lights. From this side of the Watergate complex, the floodlit dome of the Capitol building sparkled white and clear, as if sculpted in snow. Below, he could see the lights of moving traffic reflected in the Potomac. In the distance, the marble spire of the Washington Monument pointed at the sky like a rocket. It was the kind of view real estate agents spend a lot of time talking about in order to avoid mentioning the price. "Nice view," the scorpion commented, gesturing at the lights. The movement of his hand set the ice cubes in his drink tinkling. His other hand held Harris's Smith & Wesson 38.
Are you going to kill me?" Harris asked.
"Sheikh Zayed once taught me that it is easier to kill a man than to trust him."
"Trust was never a part of our relationship," Harris snapped.
Suddenly, what had happened earlier at the embassy began to make some sense.
"No, we're not in the trusting business, are we?" the scorpion admitted. "I've been promoted. I'm deputy director now, Scorpion. You can't do business without me," Harris began.
He leaned back and crossed his legs, trying to look relaxed. But with his hands tied behind him, he simply looked uncomfortable.
"How was the party at the French embassy tonight?" the scorpion asked, knowing Harris would understand and hate him for it. "Where's Kelly?" Harris demanded.
His handsome, all-American face suddenly looked very ugly. It made the scorpion think of the picture of Dorian Gray.
"What's the matter, Bob? Lose your girl?" the scorpion mildly observed. "You son of a bitch!" Harris exploded.
He tried to struggle to his feet. The scorpion's icy eyes narrowed. Harris subsided at once.
Harris swallowed hard and said, "How did you know? I didn't see you at the party."
The scorpion grinned as widely as a Cheshire cat. He pulled out something dark and furry and tossed it onto the coffee table. It lay there like a dead animal.
"It never ceases to amaze me how unobservant people are. A bit of silly putty in the nostrils, some furry foliage," gesturing at the phony beard.
"A few chest decorations and you could fool your own mother," the scorpion said, watching comprehension light in Harris's eyes as he remembered the bearded boar at the party, complaining in atrocious English about the disastrous impact of U.S. interest rates on the franc.
"What made her run away?"
"One minute she was fine, and then all at once she turned white as a ghost and bolted," Harris asked.
"In a way, she did see a ghost at the banquet. She saw you speak to Gerard," the scorpion said.
"Don't worry about Gerard. He's a dead man," Harris said.
"He's not the only one," the scorpion replied.
Harris looked away. He seemed to be glancing around his apartment. It was furnished in white and chrome in the kind of expensive yet sterile luxury which says nothing about the owner except that he has money. When Harris turned back, there was a queasy look in his eyes, as if he had swallowed something that didn't agree with him.
"How did you do it?" Harris wanted to know. Despite everything, he couldn't suppress a note of professional curiosity.
The scorpion shrugged and said,
"Given the French connection,
I knew Gerard had to be working for either the Sûreté or the STECE. STECE, Harris said. Yes. They go in for subcontracting the pushes and pimps. At that point, it was just a matter of putting out the word and offering the right amount. Harris nodded. He tried to force a smile. It looked like the smile on a politician's face as he's being grilled by reporters on his unreported taxes. You were jealous, weren't you, Scorpion? You did it to hurt her, Harris whispered. Not her. You. The sound of a police siren hee-hawing through traffic grew louder, then faded into the night. Other tragedies, the Scorpion thought. He glanced at the gleaming white monuments to dead presidents. Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln. Islands of light in a sea of darkness, like civilization itself, he mused. He thought about Kelly and sipped his drink. Harris leaned forward. He looked longingly at the Scorpion's drink and licked his lips. The Scorpion held it out and let him sip at it like a thirsty child. I couldn't stand the idea of that greasy pig Abdul Saad all over her. It kept getting in the way, Harris said. His face was pained, as if something had broken inside and he was trying to hold it together. You really take the cake, Bob. Blaming Kelly for what was your fault, not hers, the Scorpion sniffed. I can't help it, Harris confessed. Neither could she. For a long moment, neither man spoke. They sat in their dinner jackets waiting for the conversation to resume, like two retired club members who never liked each other but who are the last survivors of the old crowd and have no one else left to talk to. How did you figure it out? Harris asked quietly. In some way, the shared knowledge that they had used each other and that each of them had used Kelly made it possible to talk. Oh, I'm pretty shrewd. When I get hit in the head by a 2x4, I'm bound to take notice. Like someone with your description seen leaving Bahrain with Kelly. Another thing. Ever since the well, I knew there was another man in Kelly's life. You were my control. You should have briefed me about it, but you didn't. That was a very odd omission. Seeing you tell Gerard to fuck off at the party was only the final nail in the coffin. I should have caught on long before, the Scorpion said. How? Harris asked. His eyebrows raised in a quizzical manner that made the Scorpion think of an intelligent chipmunk. All the things I should have spotted in the first place, but was too blind and stupid to see, the Scorpion admitted. You were programmed. But never mind, we all are, Harris responded. First, it was an outside operation right from the beginning. The president and the DCI and Langley never knew about it. That's why you didn't want me to go near the CIA stations in Arabia. The Molotov plan was your idea, Bob. You knew Arabia was about to explode before it happened, so you had to have a mole in the Kremlin who either knew about it or set it up himself. You could have let the Russians know the game was up before it happened through 100 different channels, but you didn't. Because you wanted it to happen, didn't you? The Scorpion insisted. Harris nodded. That's quite a fairy tale you're concocting. Go on. But because the director wasn't involved, you needed someone to put his finger in the dike and make sure that the Russians wouldn't actually pull it off. Me, the Scorpion said, pointing at himself. You, Harris agreed. And you had to be sure to run me yourself so you could control the situation. So you chose MacCready knowing he would fuck it up and you'd be able to come in yourself, the Scorpion continued. Poor George, Harris said blandly, wearing an expression of mock sympathy that a politician might use in an opponent's funeral. Poor George nothing. He did all right. He did so all right it almost came unstuck for you. He redeemed himself, Harris. Admit it. The Scorpion insisted. Harris shrugged. You really are a rank sentimentalist, Scorpion. Forget MacReady. Everyone else did. Just get on with the story. The problem was how to hook me in. So you set up the perfect bait, and I fell for it hook, line, and sinker. The knight in shining armor, charging off to rescue the fair maiden from the nasty dragon. Given my nature and what happened in Saigon, it was perfect. You must have consulted with a brilliant psychologist or something, the Scorpion said, an edge of bitterness in his voice. Three psychiatrists, actually, Harris remarked dryly. The Scorpion nodded. The next step was to arrange for the kidnapping. That's where I should have figured it out, because there were French footprints all over it, and I never bothered to check it out. The snatch took place in Paris. Back in Peshawar, you told me the data came from the Rue des Saussayes, the Sûreté, and the SDECE, all French intelligence agencies. And you set it up with the oldest trick in the book, recruiting an amateur like Kelly for what she thought was one organization, in this case the Mossad, and actually running her for another, namely her own little op within the CIA. The Scorpion finished. Harris sat like a sphinx, not giving anything away. What makes you think she thought she was working for the Israelis? He asked dryly. In a minute. First, let's talk about why you chose Kelly. The bit about the Israelis comes out of that. You needed a beautiful blonde because of Abdul Saad's slimy little fantasies, someone you could put in the right place at the right time. Then, because of who Kelly was, Max Ormont's daughter. Ormont's family came from France originally. I should have spotted it sooner. The name Ormont, translated from French into Yiddish, is Goldberg. Max achieved the American dream. He married a beautiful, wealthy Shiksa and made millions in oil, but he didn't want his WASP friends, not to mention his Arab business partners, to know he was born Jewish. And here was Kelly rebelling against her father and going to France and maybe Israel to try to find her roots. It must have been like taking candy from a baby to recruit her for the Israelis. Did you share your little Zionist dreams with her, run off to a kibbutz and make the desert bloom? The Scorpion sneered. Go on, finish it, Harris growled. His eyes glittered with anticipation. He wanted to hear it told, the Scorpion realized, like an actor anxious for a critic's review. That's all of it. You used the little fish Kelly to catch a bigger fish, me, and me to catch Abdul Saad, and Abdul Saad's fall to catch Braithwaite and then Nuruddin and the Russians, who thought it was their op all along and never knew that you were the one who knocked over the first domino and set them all toppling. It was brilliant, Bob. A 4-star performance. And the only thing left to ask is, why? Why did you do it, Bob? Or should I ask, how much? The Scorpion finished. Harris straightened up. An odd gleam of pride came into his eyes, like a teacher watching his best pupil win a prize. He raised his eyebrow in acknowledgement, as if it were a checkered flag. $6 million, Scorpion. That's a little better than civil service pay, Harris said, a winning smile breaking across his face. You maniac! You risked World War III for a lousy profit? The Scorpion said, contempt almost choking him. Harris was indomitable. He grinned with the guilty charm of a small boy with his hand in the cookie jar. You have to admit, $6 million isn't exactly a lousy profit, he said. The Scorpion raised his glass in a silent toast to Harris. He had a certain con man style. No wonder Kelly fell for his line, he mused. The thought of her sobered him again. That was my final mistake, Bob. Not spotting it when you made that slip about somebody making a fortune in oil futures. That was how you did it, didn't you? Harris nodded amiably. Once the crisis hit the media, oil futures went sky high, he admitted. Who staked you? Who put down the cash to buy up $6 million worth of futures? Harris leaned forward, his eyes twinkling with impish evil. Can't you guess? He whispered. The scorpion sat stunned, scarcely able to believe what his mind was telling him was the obvious truth.
Max Ormont, he breathed.
Harris grinned. The great Max Ormont, pillar of society, millionaire, congressman, statesman, friend of presidents, power in the party caucus. He sold his own daughter into slavery to keep her quiet and to make a killing in the market, he agreed. The scorpion picked up his drink and sipped. It had gone flat. So had everything else somehow.
His own daughter, he repeated, shaking his head.
With a weary sigh, he aimed the gun at Harris.
Is that why you tried to terminate me in Bahrain? To keep me quiet and make a killing in the market?
He asked quietly. Don't get all holier than thou on me, Scorpion. You made $1 million on this business, too, Harris snapped.
But not as much as you, Bob. I obviously still have a lot to learn, the Scorpion said.
He cocked the gun to a hair trigger and moved the muzzle forward until it touched Harris's sweat-slicked forehead.
Wait, Scorpion. I did it to save your life and usefulness, Harris stammered.
Go on, Bob, show your whole card. I've paid a hell of a lot to see it, the Scorpion said. Sweat beaded on Harris's forehead. The Scorpion watched a drop of sweat trickle down to the tip of his nose and hang there, tempting gravity. Harris took a deep breath and began.
First of all, the Molotov plan was always a Russian idea. For centuries, it's what they've really wanted. We just deflected it our way because it gave us the chance to remove hardliners like Fyodorenko from power. That's avoiding nuclear war, not causing it.
You're damn right we have a mole in the Kremlin, and thanks to the Molotov op, he's moved to the very top. Do you understand? The Politburo itself. You're an intelligence professional. You tell me what a coup like that is worth.
As for terminating you, that was Ormont's idea. He had the Russian connection and the only motive to keep you silent. You were a danger to him, not to me. On the contrary, you got me a big promotion. In fact, you were my insurance policy against Ormont, so I deflected that one, too. But I had to let everyone think you were dead. The president wanted to give you a medal, for Christ's sakes, blow you and the whole op wide open, and if the media had caught wind of the Molotov plan, it would have been a political disaster. We would have performed the almost impossible feat of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, Harris said hurriedly.
Go on, the Scorpion said. He watched the drop hanging from Harris's nose, glimmering in the reflected lights like a seed pearl. He wondered when it would fall. If Harris fell, he would take the government with him, the Scorpion thought. Like Humpty Dumpty, not all the king's horses and all the king's men would put it together again. Not that he gave a damn about the president. One politician was little better than another. But he cared deeply about America. His father had taught him that much. He'd had so little time with that oil redneck, who had left him with little beyond the memory of a tweedy embrace and the smell of pipe tobacco. But Tim Curry had left the Scorpion with that love for what America wanted to be, if not for what it was.
Besides, if they thought you were alive, every KGB agent in the world would be on your tail right now. You're good, Scorpion, but nobody's that good. Sooner or later, they'd corner you. Bad for you, bad for us.
This way, you've been marked KIA. All records to be archived, purged, and forgotten. You're as safe as I can make you until the KGB picks up your trail again. Bahrain was the old possum ploy. Al-Amir was supposed to let you go, Harris finished. The Scorpion pressed the muzzle against Harris's forehead, as if he wanted to push it into his brain.
Was it for Kelly?
Is that why you did it?
Or didn't do it, if I'm supposed to believe you?
The Scorpion demanded harshly.
Neither,
Harris whispered. He closed his eyes.
I did it because you were too good an asset to lose.
He smiled lamely. The Scorpion watched the drop finally fall from Harris's nose. After a second, he stepped away and released the hammer on the .38. He stood for a moment, silhouetted against the skylight. The hell of it was that everything Harris said made sense.
I have a little business to take care of, and then I'm going to see her again, he said, not looking at Harris.
Harris exhaled loudly like a diver coming up for air.
Am I to assume that an off-year election to fill Ormont's soon-to-be-vacated congressional seat is anticipated? He asked innocently.
The Scorpion said nothing.
He won't be missed. Not by anyone, especially Kelly, Harris added.
You never had her, you know. It was all bullshit. You're not the kibbutz type, the Scorpion said, turning to face Harris.
Do you know where she's going? Harris asked.
I can make a pretty educated guess.
It won't work, you two, Harris insisted.
I know, the Scorpion said.
Then why? Why dig it all up?
The Scorpion shrugged, then turned, a boyish smile dimpling his right cheek.
I'm sentimental, he said.
Harris grunted and shifted uncomfortably on the couch. His hands ached fiercely from the knots, and he knew it would take hours to undo them and get help, which was precisely the head start the Scorpion wanted. His mouth hurt viciously from the kick. He explored a loose tooth with his tongue and wondered if it could be saved. He looked up at the Scorpion.
You know what your problem is, Scorpion? You're a romantic, Harris declared triumphantly.
And you're not, Bob. That's your weakness.
Dallas, UPI. Congressman Max Ormont, Republican, Texas, plunged to his death from the balcony of his high-rise penthouse early this morning. Paramedics from Dallas Memorial pronounced him dead at the scene at 11:53 p.m. The multimillionaire oil man turned politician had returned to Dallas for a political fundraiser before leaving on a fact-finding trip to the Soviet Union, police officials said. Preliminary indications are that the congressman may have been drinking. However, determination of the cause of death is pending the coroner's report.
There appears to be no evidence of foul play, but our investigation is continuing, said Darrell Dobson, chief of homicide.
There were no witnesses to the incident.
The congressman is survived by a daughter. She could not be reached for comment.
Ean Gev. The restaurant was on a tiny spit of land sandwiched between the sheer ridge of the Golan and the lake. Two wooden fishing boats, belonging to the kibbutz, were turned upside down on the rocky beach bordering the terrace. During the day, fishermen from the kibbutz fished for the small, bony St. Peter's fish, which made the restaurant famous. Men had always fished these waters. Even in prehistoric times, fishermen had harvested here, leaving nothing behind but the name they gave to the lake. They called it Kinneret, because its shape reminded them of a harp. The name was kept by the Hebrews, who documented it in their records, which became the Bible, until the Romans came and gave it the name of the soft rolling hills to the west. They called it the Sea of Galilee. And so it stayed for 2,000 years until the Jews returned to reclaim the land and rename the lake once more. Kinneret again, still harp-shaped, still mysterious. It was the dusk hour. The restaurant was closed. A couple sat on the deserted terrace and looked out over the lake, turned to molten gold by the last rays of the sun. Across the lake, they could clearly see the rounded outlines of the hills of Galilee against the red sky. The Shabbat stillness was complete, except for the lapping of the waves against the low terrace wall a few feet from their table. At such a moment, it was easy to imagine Jesus walking along this shore, followed at a distance by the shy fishermen of the village, struggling to understand what he meant by talking about love in a world which seemed to have no place for it.
This is where she thinks she belongs, the Scorpion thought, looking across at Kelly.
She was slim and tan and healthy-looking, in a frayed white shirt and khaki shorts. This is her world now,
as alien to her as Arabia. But she believes in it, and maybe that makes it her world, he thought. Call me Chava, she had told him, when he found her at Kibbutz Shar HaGolan in the Jordan Valley where Wadi Yarmouk divides the three territories, Jordan, Israel, and the occupied Golan. After dinner in the kibbutz dining hall, they had driven the 3 or 4 miles to the restaurant at Ein Gev. I wanted to show you this, she said, gesturing at the lake. I like to come here on Erev Shabbat when it's quiet like this. It's a special place. I can see why they called it a land of milk and honey coming out of the desert, he said. The mention of the desert brought back the memory of Arabia. The shadow of it flickered in her wonderful violet eyes, and she looked away for a second. The scorpion cursed himself for being an idiot. I'm sorry about your father, he said, keeping his voice carefully neutral. Don't be. Nobody else is. She shrugged, her face a mask against pain. I suspect you'll be inheriting quite a lot, he said. It's a lot, she agreed gravely. You could go anywhere, do anything, he said. I am doing something, she said, her chin set defiantly. She sat up straight and looked directly at him, wearing her independence like a flag. I know, he said. A bullfrog croaked down by the water's edge. Across the lake, he could see the lights of the resort town of Tiberias shining on the water. Under Prince Judah, the rabbis of Israel had written the Mishnah and determined the final form of the Old Testament there. Nearby twinkled the lights of Kfar Nahum, the biblical Capernaum where Jesus used to preach. There was no escaping the past in a place like this, he thought. She leaned across and kissed him on the mouth, her hand at the back of his neck, and for a moment they were lovers in the truest sense. Then he thought of Harris, and the shadows of the past fell between them like a guillotine blade. You know why I had to leave Bahrain with Robert, don't you? I thought he was my case officer, she said, looking down for a moment. And I had to find out where we stood with each other. She said in that throaty voice, which still tugged at his heart like a string. But I never thought he was, when I saw Gerard and him talking at the party and realized they were in it together, she began, her eyes shining. Back in Paris, you thought that one of the men you met, Gerard or Jean-Paul or Randy, was a contact from Israeli intelligence, didn't you? She nodded. They were contacts, all right. Small-time informers working for the French SDECE. It was Harris who was pulling the strings, he said. Some Mata Hari. I was pretty naive, wasn't I? She asked softly. Yes, he said, and held her close. She vibrated in his arms like a tuning fork. He held her until she was still, knowing it was a moment he would remember until he died. She pulled away and looked directly into his eyes, as if peering into the back of his brain. No one had ever looked at him like that, he thought. You're the most special man I've ever known, she said. And he knew it was her way of saying goodbye. Don't underestimate yourself either. There'll be lots of nights when trying not to think about you will be the hardest thing I'll ever have to do, he said. She cupped his chin in her hand and smiled fondly. My knight in shining armor, she said, her eyes brimming again. But it wouldn't work. Somehow I can't picture you in a kibbutz cow barn shoveling manure. That's not how the story goes. The knight's supposed to kiss his lady fair goodbye and ride off to his next adventure. So where's your next adventure? She said bravely. I have some unfinished business in Afghanistan, he said, wishing it didn't sound so much like Indiana Jones. You see, she said brightly, her mouth twisting as if she was about to cry. He reached towards her and then hesitated. He let his hand drop onto the table and lay there like something dead. I could try. Who knows, maybe I'd like Kibbutz life, he ventured awkwardly. She put her hand to his cheek. Dear Nick, you know that's not you. There are 100 reasons. You're not Jewish, and that matters here. But mostly you'd resent it because that's not who you are. And I'd resent it because I'm a romantic too, and I love who you are. They looked helplessly at each other. You're right, he said. A yellowish full moon rose over the brooding shadow of the Golan Heights and shone down on the lake like a beacon, its light shattered into millions of fragments. Beware the Russians. Robert told me you're number one on their list, she said, concern etched on her face. I won't forget the Russians, the scorpion said in a quiet voice. She shook her head and looked out over the water, shining white as fields of snow in the moonlight. She listened to the lapping of the waves and the croaking of the frogs and tried to think of a way to say goodbye. Smile, Kelly. Let him remember you smiling, she told herself, and turned to face him. The terrace was deserted. The scorpion had gone. Moscow. Fyodorenko sat unmoving as a statue in the penal chair. His famous stone face stood him in good stead, giving nothing away even now, as Suvorov's searing invective poured over him like molten metal. Every face was turned towards him, their hatred naked and plain to see at long last. He had seen it before and understood it well. They were like a pack of wolves tearing one of their own to pieces as soon as he went down. Always before, he had led the attack. This time, they were attacking him. 2 6-foot blonde Neanderthals stood at his sides. As soon as this little farce had been played out, they would take him out to the courtyard and bundle him into a limousine. It would be a short ride, he knew. It wasn't far from the Kremlin to the Black Wall in Lubyanka prison. Now Andreev, head of the KGB, joined the attack. His voice cracked like a whiplash as he denounced Fyodorenko as a mad dog enemy of the people. That wasn't his crime, of course, Fyodorenko knew. He was guilty of the only crime in the world for capitalist or communist alike. Failure. Fyodorenko's glance fell on Svetlov, the newest member of the Politburo. It was his reward for betraying Fyodorenko to Suvorov and Andreev. Svetlov's bulging frog eyes blinked repeatedly as he stared in sneering triumph at Fyodorenko. Yes, I engineered your downfall, and I'm glad of it, his eyes said. But his triumph would be short-lived, Fyodorenko thought grimly. At least he made sure of that. After the Molotov plan had fallen apart, he had launched a complete top-secret security check on everyone involved. The only way the Scorpion could have been positioned to interfere was if there had been a leak. His agents reported that there had been meetings between Svetlov and the capitalist Ormont. Then there was the rumor surfaced by the KGB that the Scorpion wasn't dead and that he was the one who had terminated Ormont in Dallas. But up until last night, he still hadn't known what hold Ormont had had on Svetlov. Then he got a midnight call from Novorossiysk. One of his agents found Svetlov's great-aunt still alive. Under torture, the old woman had revealed that Svetlov's mother was a Jewess and that Svetlov's twin brother hadn't been killed by the British as Svetlov had claimed all these years. The Jews had smuggled the infant to France, where the family name Goldberg was translated to Ormont. But by then it was too late. Svetlov had made his move. Fyodorenko barely had time to pass a hand-scribbled note to his housekeeper with instructions to get it to Kishinev. Although the foreign minister was his enemy and was now staring at him with barely concealed delight, Fyodorenko knew Kishinev would know how to use the information against Svetlov. As for himself, it didn't matter. The Molotov plan was too big a fiasco to paper over by pointing the finger at Svetlov. Suddenly it was over. Calling him a sukinsin for the last time, Suvorov motioned for the guards to take him away. Fyodorenko stood and faced his accusers.
"What I did for the good of the party," he said.
His words were met by stony silence. He remembered his father reading something from the Bible when he was a child, something about wheat sown on stony ground. Strange, he hadn't thought of that in so many years. As they led him from the room, he heard Svetlov's voice cut through the silence. It was for his benefit, too. Svetlov wanted him to hear it, Fyodorenko thought.
"And now, comrades, the next item of business is to order a worldwide effort to terminate the enemy agent known as the Scorpion," Svetlov said.
Epilogue. The old man was dying at last. Frankly, Captain Mayakovsky was surprised he had lasted so long. But these Pathan tribesmen were tough. They had been torturing the old buzzard for 6 hours straight, and he hadn't told them a thing about the Scorpion. Mayakovsky walked to the doorway of the army hut and glanced outside. The landscape here in the Khyber Pass was the most desolate anyone could imagine. Bare rock gullies and mountains, one after another like waves of the sea, with nothing green growing for as far as the eye could see. It looked like the debris left over after the world had been made. In every gully there were 1,000 places for the Mujahideen to hide, every one of them a crack shot. The children here had rifles in their hands before they could walk. His eyes roamed the barren scene, the air shimmering like water in the baking heat. It was the most godforsaken, fly-bitten ass-end spot on earth, he thought. He longed for the green parks of Moscow and the taste of ice-cold kvass. They were wasting their time. He had told those GRU idiots that. All of the tribes in these parts were Pathans. They never talked. The GRU officer had looked blankly at Mayakovsky as if he didn't understand Russian.
"Orders are orders," the officer had pedantically remarked.
Mayakovsky shrugged. Orders were orders, but the sooner he got out of this godforsaken shithole, the better. With a sigh, he turned back and motioned to his men. Once again, they took the red-hot iron from the coals and held it to the old man's feet, the skin long since burnt to a blackened crisp. The old man's thin scream pierced the silent hut. His breathing was labored. He was going, Mayakovsky thought. He leaned down to the old man's ear. A fly buzzed his cheek as he did so, and he irritably brushed it away.
"Tell me where the Scorpion is, and I'll make the pain go away," Mayakovsky whispered seductively.
The old man's eyes were half closed. Mayakovsky wasn't sure he even heard him. But the old man had heard. His pain would soon be over, he knew. Soon Allah would gather him into his bosom, and he would drink the cool waters of the Fount of Selsabil. What a fool this Russian was, he thought, as if anyone could reveal the Scorpion's whereabouts. The Scorpion was as the desert wind. The old man smiled. Who can capture the wind?
This has been an Audible Studios production of Scorpion, written by Andrew Kaplan, performed by Victor Bavine. Producer, Mike Charzuk. Copyright 1985 by Andrew Kaplan. This edition published in 2014 by Open Road Integrated Media, Inc. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.